Thank you for coming. This is the first of two parts of a conversation about race and redemption. Title probably said race and reconciliation. That's another word we might use. Some of our African-American friends don't like that word as much for reasons that we'll talk about. So today what we're going to do is talk about that theme and talk about it in the context of the survey that we did on October 1st, and we'll refer to that a little bit later on, and also the strategic direction of the church and some things that Westminster has been involved in for quite a while and several people here are actively involved in. Does everybody have a copy of the handout? Yes? Sarah's got extras if anybody needs them. Okay. So what I like to do, as usual, is talk for a little bit and then stop and then invite conversation. And again, our topic is the whole work of Westminster in regard to race and redemption and reconciliation in the context of the survey that we did in October and our strategic direction. So as always, let's begin with a prayer and then we'll start. Oh, gracious God, we do thank you for this time to be together. We thank you for this church. We thank you for the body of Christ that includes all of us here and all your children everywhere. And we thank you especially for the opportunities that we've had to draw near to friends who are people of color, precious to you and therefore increasingly precious to us as well as we develop friendships in the bond of Christ. So open our hearts and minds and bless our conversation to the end that we might grow in understanding and faith and hope and love and also live and act to serve you faithfully. We ask in Christ's name. Amen. I want to start by telling you a little story about my friend Peter. Peter is a tall, handsome, well-educated man who is a lawyer and a law professor, whom I first met in Carlisle because he was on the committee, the pastor nominating committee that called me to go to Carlisle and be the pastor at Second Pres before we came here. Peter was the assistant dean of the Dickinson Law School, now Penn State Law School. Since then, he's gone on to be the dean of two other law schools in other parts of the country. He has a wonderful voice, and he would sing at the early service. We had a similar schedule there as we have here. So we had an early service, and instead of the quartet, we had a trio. And the other two people were two ladies named Polly and Mary. So as you can imagine, they were known as Peter, Polly, and Mary. They were our trio on Sunday mornings, and they had this wonderful music, the three of them together. So one day, Peter and I were going to lunch, and he said, "Where do you want to go?" And I said, "Well, how about Cracker Barrel?" And he said, "Don't want to go to Cracker Barrel." "Well, why not, Peter?" "Well, because Cracker Barrel's not so good to people like me." "What do you mean?" Well, Peter, of course, was an African-American man. And at the time, nearly 20 years ago, Cracker Barrel had a reputation, particularly in the South, but also in other parts of the country, of not treating well employees and some customers who were people of color. And so, of course, we didn't go to Cracker Barrel. But that was probably my first experience of what has come to be called white privilege. That's a term that causes a lot of antagonism among white folk. But it has to do, first of all, with the kind of cluelessness that so many of us have. Would not have occurred to me. I had no reason to know that Cracker Barrel would not be a good place to go with my black assistant law school dean friend. That just wouldn't have occurred to me. And that's part of the point. When African-American folks talk about white privilege, that's what they mean. They mean we just have these advantages in being white. There's a whole bunch of stuff that we just don't have to think about that they have to think about all the time. By and large, just look around the room. By and large, we don't experience discrimination in housing. Nobody ever redlined us out of living in a certain neighborhood. We don't experience discrimination in voting. People don't draw voter district lines to minimize the access of people like us to get to the polls. When we see police officers coming, I'm guessing most of us feel like these are the good guys. They're here to protect us, and we can count on them, and we feel safe when the police are around. We never experienced racial slurs. People don't tell jokes about folks like us. We don't have to worry about employment interviews because our names might be different and we might not get a chance to even to get the interview. We don't have to think about those things. That's part of what they mean when they talk about white privilege, that we don't have to think about being white. We just are. That's just sort of normal. We're just the people. But black folks have to think about being black just about every day. Many of you know Gavin Walton, who, you know that story. Ed and Jason and I went to the seminary to try to find a student for the coming year, and we liked Anna Marie, and we liked Gavin, and so the guys said, well, you know, what are we going to do? And I said, well, let's take them both. So the joke for a while was that we went to the hospital and came home with twins, you know? We brought back Anna Marie and we brought back Gavin, and many of you have gotten to know Gavin, just wonderfully gifted young man. His dad is black, his mom is white, just a marvelously gifted young preacher. And when Gavin was with us for a couple of years, he would talk in a way that was just very welcoming and enlightening about some of the experience of being black, and in his case, actually not being entirely black. He would talk about not fitting in ideally with either community, not black enough for some black folks, not white enough for some white folks. He talked about his own experience and other young black men's experience of being pulled over for driving while black, and that they get stopped much more frequently for no apparent reason. And when they do get stopped, you might get stopped for a taillight and a cop might come up behind you and say, sir, ma'am, you need to get your taillight fixed. They might have two or three police cars roll up and guns unsnapped, ready to be drawn. And they all get the talk, Gavin told us, the talk from their parents, meaning, look, son, if you get pulled over by the police, you be careful, you keep your hands on the steering wheel. If you're going to reach to get your driver's license out of your pocket or out of the glove compartment, you tell them what you're going to do. You keep one hand on the steering wheel. You do that slowly and carefully because this could be the last thing you ever do. White people don't face that. You get pulled over by a police officer, it doesn't even occur to you that the guy might be thinking that I'm going to pull a gun on him and this is going to lead to a confrontation and possibly a death. So black folks have started to talk about white privilege. And in my experience, when white people hear that, initially at least, almost always the reaction is some combination of defensiveness and dismissiveness. People say, I'm not privileged. I work for everything I have. Nobody gave me anything. I've worked hard to get what I have. What do you mean, white privilege? I don't have any privilege. And then sometimes people will say those things in contrast to maybe some welfare stereotypes that have become common in the last 30 or 40 years in this country. And then I hear white folks saying, yeah, come on, you know, slavery and segregation, yeah, those were awful things, of course, and we all agree with that. But that was in the past, you know. Slavery's been gone a long, long time. Lincoln put an end to that. Segregation, you know, we had the Civil Rights Act in the 60s, and we had the Voting Rights Act in the 60s, and that's behind us, too, and there's been affirmative action for so long, and actually we've got reverse discrimination now. Sometimes, you know, white kids have a hard time getting into a school because there are these quotas, and we just had Barack Obama, we had a black man as president of the United States. So what's the problem here? You know, yes, of course, our country has this unfortunate history. That's all in the past. It's time to move on. And then people will often add, because virtually all of us are descendants of immigrants, people will say, when my parents came over from, fill in the blank, Scotland, England, Ireland, Italy, whatever, when my grandparents came over, they didn't have a penny, and they worked hard, and they saved, and they got ahead. These people just want everything to be handed to them. I'm pretty sure that you've heard people say that sort of thing. And that's because we don't have to think about all the ways in which being people of color, and especially being black in this country, creates barriers to all sorts of things that we just take for granted, and that's what they tend to mean when they talk about white privilege. So what happens in my experience is white folks and black folks tend to focus on different things, and they often talk past each other. And so much of that conversation is driven by the fact that their experiences are so different, and they live, in a sense, in different sort of moral worlds, different experiential worlds. And because our society is still, to a great extent, certainly this area is to a great extent, living in the midst of a sort of de facto segregation, people don't know each other. I mean, just look at the congregation, look around here. Go out, drive up and down the street, run through Upper St. Clair, Peter's Township, Bethel Park. How many people that don't look like us are you likely to encounter? We live in a world of de facto segregation, many of us, and that's not entirely coincidental for some people. It's not coincidental because years ago there was redlining, which of course is that term used when realtors would say to people of color, oh, you probably want a house in this neighborhood, because they weren't about to sell or show a house to somebody in a neighborhood where the white folks weren't going to want them to come. So we live in this world of sort of de facto segregation, many of us, and part of what that means is we don't have many friends who are not like us. We don't know each other as human beings, and so we tend to think of each other in generalizations and sort of stereotypical categories. Now, I spent a lot of time reading psychology, and I still do, and to some extent, generalizations are cognitively necessary. We have thousands of experiences every day, and so when we see somebody or some situation, we immediately sort of lump it together in a cluster of a sort of class, a category of things, just to make sense of the world. It's sort of an initial take on our experience of the world. And so it's not at all surprising, and not even necessarily bad, that when we see somebody, we immediately sort of register that person as a woman or a man, a black person or a white person, or an Asian person. We do that inevitably, and there's nothing at all wrong with that. We have to. That's just a cognitive function. But, of course, the danger arises when we form these stereotypes, and especially negative stereotypes, about whole classes of people, because we hear things, we see things in the news, we hear things on the radio, and so now these, rather than being human beings, instead of being Peter or Susan or Fred, these are not human beings, these are not people, these are instances of a category, and we have assumptions and stereotypes about those categories. White folks can afford to think of others in terms of stereotypes and categories because doing that doesn't impact our lives in negative ways, by and large. And in some ways, we think it helps to keep us safer and insulated from problems. We can even afford to ignore, by and large, the challenges that black folk face. Black people can't afford to ignore the attitudes of white people. And again, that's one of the things that they talk about when they talk about white privilege. It's just easier to be white in this country than it is to be black. And that, of course, leads to movements like Black Lives Matter. And as you know, that movement started some years ago particularly when there was a series of encounters between police officers or sometimes civilians, as in the case of Trayvon Martin, and some usually young black man gets killed, and then whoever does it doesn't experience the consequences that many in the black community felt should have been imposed. And sometimes it's police officers that are involved in those shootings. And after that happened several times in rapid succession around the country, as you know, a lot of protests, a lot of concern about that, and a movement arose that began with the sort of tagline, Black Lives Matter. And that became yet another reason in our polarized society for people to go to their corners of the boxing ring, and to mix metaphors, everybody goes to DEFCON 3 and gets ready to fight, you know? And so when the black folks say Black Lives Matter, most of them would say, you can't just shoot us and get away with it. That's not right. You can't do that if you're a police officer. You can't do that if you're a civilian. And we've got all these stand your ground laws, and some guy thinks he can pull out his gun and he can claim that he's harassed. And some of those laws say all you have to do is think you were in danger, and that's the standard that justifies your shooting and possibly killing somebody. People can get away with that now. But Black Lives Matter, they say. And at one level, of course, that's just common sense. Of course, black lives matter. At the most basic level, people are just stating the obvious. But of course, in our polarized, hyper-tribalized society, fed by all kinds of media and other interests, that creates a reaction. Well, all lives matter, white folks started to say. Well, of course all lives matter. Of course all lives matter. And then people who have respect for law enforcement officers, and of course all of us should have respect for law enforcement officers, they put their lives on the line, they have a dangerous job, they get killed in the line of action, as we just had in this city a week or two ago. And of course, blue lives matter too. And that's self-evident, isn't it? I mean, isn't it self-evident that all lives matter, particularly if you're a Christian? All lives are important in the sight of God. And of course, blue lives, meaning police officers, people who wear blue uniforms often, those matter. Those are all statements of common sense. And they wouldn't be controversial, except that people say them by way of negating the other. And so black folk want to say, well, black lives matter. And then white folk say, well, all lives matter. And if all they meant was, yes, of course, all lives matter, that'd be fine. But all lives matter means so don't you be claiming anything special. Don't you claim that your lives are more important than our lives. And by the way, I know a police officer, and those guys put their lives on the line, and blue lives matter. And people start slinging these slogans back and forth to negate the substance and the concern of the people that began by saying, yeah, well, black lives matter. And of course, for white folk, police officers, law enforcement in general, the courts and police officers represent law and order. And for a long time, probably forever, law and order has been a principal appeal to principally white folk who have been concerned about what they see as crime and violence in society. And so somebody runs for office on a platform of law and order and minimum sentencing, and we're going to put the bad guys away, and three strikes and you're out, and zero tolerance for drugs and all that stuff. And that appeals to white folk for a couple of reasons. Number one, we see law enforcement and the courts, by and large, as benevolent and on our side. The experience of many African-American folks is very different. And when it comes to drug possession, you know, some kid in Upper St. Clair gets caught with some drugs at the mall or someplace, yeah, he might get arrested. But you know, the dad or mom is going to call somebody and call the attorney and say, let's work something out. And the likelihood of the white kid in the suburbs getting sent up for years for being caught with some drugs is relatively small. The likelihood of a black kid in the city getting caught for drugs, likelihood of going away to jail for a longer period of time is substantially greater. Some of us have a friend now, actually at Grace Memorial Church, who as a young man, he actually had some heroin. Not a lot, he says, but he had some heroin. He went away for 25 years, 23 years, something like that. He's now a deacon at Grace Memorial Church and has a marvelous testimony, and many of us now consider him becoming a dear friend. He spent 20-some years in jail for having an amount of heroin. Now, heroin's not a good thing to have, of course, and there should be penalties for that. But he spent 23 or 25 years of his life locked away for that. The likelihood of a white kid from Upper St. Clair doing that is dramatically lower. So what happens is, this whole business of race gets fed into the tribalism and the politics and psychology of identity in our day that's just so prevalent. And that's for all kinds of reasons, but not least because we live in these relatively homogeneous enclaves. We live in our own bubbles. So, of course, our families tend to have similar experiences. We choose like-minded friends because you're not going to be friends with people that have radically different views. You're not going to get together with people that you get into an argument over politics or something every time. So we tend to choose like-minded friends. We live in relatively homogeneous communities. And, of course, as we all know, we can now get news sources and information and opinion sources that are tailor-made to fit what we already believe, right? So if you get all your news and information and perspectives from Fox News and the Wall Street Journal's editorial page, you're likely to have one view on the world. If you get all your news and information from MSNBC and maybe the New York Times and maybe Mother Jones, you're likely to see the world in a somewhat different way. And because you're busy, you don't necessarily have a big incentive to listen to all of those and see what everybody's saying. So the result of all this is we have our opinions, we have our like-minded circle of family and friends, we have that reinforced by the media that we choose to listen to, who, by the way, have a commercial incentive to reinforce what we believe because that's what pays for advertising and books and viewership. And that's just in the commercial media, not to mention all the things that are available on the internet, where anybody who has anything to say about anything without being vetted at all may have the most wild, unfounded, crazy perspective. That goes out on the internet, and you can get a following of thousands of people with nobody holding you accountable for what you say. And we all know about instances of that. So the upshot here. The upshot here is we live in a society where a sizable portion of the population sees the world very differently from the way you and I are likely to see it based on our experience. And it's very, very easy, especially if you live in a suburban homogeneous community like this, it's very, very easy to have our worldview reinforced. And so you come to think that all right-thinking people think like I do. Well, if that's true, if all right-thinking people think like me, we know that there are people who think otherwise, then you have to account for that. So how is it that these people don't think the way I and all my right-minded friends think? Well, there are basically two broad possibilities. One is that they're just ignorant. They don't know the facts, and so we've got to educate them about what's true. The other alternative is that in some sense they're just immoral. In some sense they don't care about the right things. They have their own sort of perverse self-interest. They don't care about working hard. They don't care about the things that I care about. And sometimes you'll hear people say, those people hate, and then fill in the blank. Those people hate freedom. Those people hate responsibility. Those people hate America. Those people hate God. I told you once about getting on some website. I said this in a sermon once, I think, where I came across a website that is very popular, has millions of followers. And one of the first headlines I saw was, liberals hate Christianity. What? Liberals hate Christianity? Who's the liberal that you have in mind? Right? This is on a website with millions of followers. And people who get all their news and information and perspective from websites like that can get away with thinking that whatever they consider to be a liberal, which is basically somebody that doesn't agree with them, those people hate Christianity. Start saying these ludicrous, absurd generalizations. And in the most extreme forms, they start to see these groups of people for whom we have no personal relationships that violate the stereotypes. They start to see whole groups of people as not just poorly informed, but in some sense morally inferior, possibly even evil. And the result, of course, of that is that I have no responsibility to care about them. All I need to do is keep them away from me, keep them from harming anything or anyone that I care about. And if they're not doing well, they probably get what they deserve because they have all these moral faults. Well, that's the world we live in. Now, I hope to goodness, and I believe, looking around the room here, that is not the characteristic attitude of most people here at Westminster. I believe that. But it is a characteristic set of attitudes of many of our neighbors. And black folk have to think about that every day. They have to think about being black in America in a way that white folks don't have to. So I think from a Christian perspective, this will not surprise you, that sort of tribalism, this hostility, this animosity based on stereotypes, that's not good enough for people who claim to follow Jesus. This should come as no surprise. I should not even have to convince you of that. So let me just say, the golden rule, the great commandment, love your neighbor as yourself, when the lawyer says to Jesus, and by the way, who's my neighbor? Looking for a lawyerly loophole. Jesus tells the story of what? The Good Samaritan. Why? Because Samaritans were not like us. That's the whole point. For us, Good Samaritan is all sort of one long word. But in Jesus' day, precisely the point of the parable of the Good Samaritan was the hero in the story is not from our tribe, not like us. So I'm not going to belabor that point because I trust that the folk in this room are already persuaded by that. That the tribalism, the hostility, the injustices that follow from that are not good enough for people who claim to follow Jesus. So then, what do we do about that? That's our question. So, to that end, let me refer to two documents. They are on opposite sides of this little handout. The first one, the one in color, is a tabulation of the responses to the social issues questions of our October 1st survey. Now, if you were here on October 1st, you may recall, we took about 12 minutes out of the service and just said, all right, everybody, stop what you're doing, answer this little survey. I made a serious withdrawal from the love bank for some people. One sweet older woman came out and said, I want my money back. And she's a dear friend. And she was teasing me because she said, I brought a friend to hear your sermon and there wasn't any sermon. I want my money back today. She was saying that as a sweet joke. But if you were here, you know that we took about 12 minutes out of the service. And the reason we did that on the first Sunday of the month was more people show up on the first Sunday of the month than on any other Sunday. Not coincidentally because the children are singing. And we have a captive audience. And we thought, we're going to get more responses off the top of people's heads in this way than we will in every other way. The two surveys that we did in 2010 and 2013 got around 400 responses. We got 505. And we understand that people came away and said, you know what, if I had time to think about this, I would have answered differently. I didn't really get through the whole. We understand all that. But what we got in about 12, 15 minutes was a sort of apples to apples, off the top of the head comparison of what 505 people thought about these things. And you may recall there were three parts of it. What kinds of things help you grow in your faith? How does your faith play out in various aspects of your life? And do you think the church should or should not address these various issues? And are you already involved in them or do you want to learn more and so forth? So this is the portion of the survey where people indicated that the church should, the percentage of people who indicated the church should address these various issues. You can see what they are. And they are arranged from the highest to the lowest response. And the blue bar, I should have had, I didn't quite take time to have a more helpful interpretive comment than series one and series two. Series one is the percentage of people who answered the question. 505 people took the survey. Not everybody answered every question. And so if you look at Jeannie Schott's summary in this month's Spire, you'll see the actual number of people who answered each question. So the blue bar is the percentage of the people who answered that particular question who said, yes, the church should address this issue. And the red bar is the percentage of all 505 people, and they may not have answered the question. So the point is, the range of possibilities for the percentage of Westminster folk who say the church should answer this question is between the red bar as a minimum and the blue bar as a maximum, right? Because the people who didn't answer the question, we don't know. Would they have said, yes, we should? No, we shouldn't. We can't assume. But we know that not fewer than what the red bar says, said the church should address this. And possibly as many as what the blue bar says. And you see the issues. We won't go through them all. Caring for the elderly, not surprisingly, is the strongest positive response. And I think that's because either we are elderly or we hope to become elderly. And we hope somebody's going to care for us when we are. So 98% of the people who answered the survey question said, yeah, the church should talk about caring for the elderly. That's kind of a no-brainer. Other things that had very high percentages, you see, homelessness, poverty, domestic violence. That's interesting. Peace and conflict resolution, all very high levels of response, either by the blue bar or by the red bar. And racism comes in at, what, number six there? In the middle of the response, but a minimum of 75% of the people who, of all the people who took the survey, and about 85% of the people who answered the question said yes. We should talk about race. That's something the church should address. The actual percentages are 85% of those who answered, 74% of all the participants. So that's right smack in the middle. And in round numbers, what that means is that 3/4 of the people who were here on October 1st, at all three services, by the way, said, yeah, the church ought to talk about this. I actually thought that was a very encouraging thing, given our homogeneous community in which we live. I will not say much about the two least supported topics, except to say that LGBTQ had a significant number of question marks by it, which I took to mean a lot of people didn't know quite what that was about and didn't answer the question. And climate and environment actually had the lowest percentage of people saying the church should talk about that. And if I remember correctly, the red bar is approximately 45%, and the blue bar, 45 or 46%. And the blue bar is about 55 or 56%. In other words, 55 or 56% of the people who answered the question said, yeah, the church should talk about climate and environment. As a percentage of all the people who took the survey is about 45 or 46%. So in round numbers, about half the people who took the survey said, yeah, the church ought to talk about this. I think there are reasons why that bar is so low, but I'm not going to talk about those today. That's for another seminar. So you see that there's a lot of support, roughly three-quarters of the congregation. And by the way, Craig Marshall, who happened to do the lighting of the candle today with his wife, Wendy, Craig Marshall very generously contributed the survey to us and produced the data and gave us access to the data so that we can look for all kinds of things, parsing the data in various ways. Craig, who does this sort of thing for a living, said, if you have a congregation of 1,700 members, and that's sort of nominal, of course, some of those folks are only nominally involved, and you get 505 responses, that's an extraordinarily strong representation of the congregation. He said, we'll take 500 responses for a city the size of Des Moines, Iowa, and consider that to be a fair representation of the community. So this survey based on 505 people at Westminster is a highly reliable snapshot of what people had to say about that issue. Given the context, short period of time, off the top of your head, what do you think? So that's my way of saying a lot of support for talking about this here. Look at the other side for a moment. I'll talk a minute about the strategic direction. And then we'll talk about some things Westminster is actually doing, and then we'll have conversation. So every 3 years since I've been here, we've had a little group of people working on what we call strategic direction. We're avoiding calling it strategic plan because those of you from business or nonprofit environments know sometimes people produce plans and they'll say, Joe will do thing X by date Y and Mary will do thing A by date B. And you have these very concrete things and measures and all those people will get evaluated on their performance by that sort of thing. That's not what we're doing. We're not saying we're going to accomplish this particular thing by that particular date. We've had an intentionally more general approach to this to say, they're more like compass headings. They're more like directions that we want to go, things we want to pursue as themes. In the first two rounds, we produced a little 4 or 5 page document. When we did it this last year, and we looked sort of 3 years out, when we did it this last year, we said, let's not produce a long document. Let's just have bullet points and focus on issues that or themes that we think we ought to pursue. So you'll see this is organized by major themes, some changes, developing practices, and so forth. Let me just point to the themes, because you'll see how they relate to this topic. And I mentioned this very briefly in the little communion meditation in worship. Be a community of confession, reconciliation, and redemption. That sounds like church talk. It is church talk, I guess. But those are deeply substantive things. In a society so full of tribal self-righteousness, so full of contention and division, my people are right, those people hate the values that I care about. In a society like that, which has increasingly become characteristic of our society, being a community of confession, reconciliation, and redemption is no trivial thing. Confession meaning we confess our own sins, not somebody else's, right? Our society is very good at confessing other people's sins, not so good at confessing their own. Here, we confess our own. Once in a while, somebody says, why do you do that confession thing? That's such a downer. Well, we do that confession thing because before the righteousness and justice of God, none of us measures up all that well, right? And so the world compares itself to some very low moral bar. We compare ourselves to the bar that Jesus sets. Love God with all your heart, mind, and soul. Love your neighbor as yourself. By that measure, we're not doing so well. We ought to be a community of confession where we confess our own sins, not somebody else's. Reconciliation. We must not, as the church, be content to feed the tribalism that is so pervasive in our culture. There are churches that do that. There are churches that take sides in the political culture wars, food fight, and say, we're on this team, and they reinforce whatever view they happen to stand for. We say, we don't want to be that. We want to be a community of reconciliation. That's not about not having strong values. On the contrary, it's about everyone bringing the values that we think Jesus raises up for us, bringing them to the congregation. And if in spite of sharing those values, we see some things differently, let's talk. Let's seek reconciliation. And let's be on the side of God's redemption in the world. This whole Advent season is about redemption, right? It's about God taking the bad stuff and redeeming it. New heaven and new earth. And so let's be a community that reflects all of that. Let's acknowledge and help to heal the pervasive angst, if you're a little more German, fear in our society. You know there are people who make a living being fearmongers in our day. That's what they do. It sells books. It gets them invitations to speak at groups. It gets them advertisers on their programs. And it creates a whole lot of anxiety, a whole lot of free-floating fear and dread and angst. Let's acknowledge that that's the case, and let's be on the side of helping to heal that in the society insofar as we can. Let's connect with people whose faith has been shaken by the church. Now, people have had bad experiences in the church, and it's not just Catholic people who had experiences with priests that did bad things. That gets all the news, of course, and we all know that. And some Protestants have done bad things in those respects, too. It's not just that. There's an entire generation of young people. I teach at Carnegie Mellon now, part-time. There's an entire generation of young people whose whole lives have identified Christianity with a certain rather vocal, rather strident political perspective. Their entire lives, they think of Christianity as being what you might call, for a placeholder, the Christian right. And their attitude is, if that's Christianity, I want no part of it. And their attitude is, if that's what church is about, I don't hear Jesus saying that to the extent that they know about Jesus, but I hear the church saying that. And that kind of church has been hurtful to a lot of people. I want nothing to do with that. So our Westminster Strategic Direction Group thought, well, let's be conscious of those people. And it's an entire generation, many of them. Let's be conscious of those people and try to connect with them if they feel that for whatever reason they've been hurt or they're angry at the church. This is not about compromising what we believe. If you've been around Westminster any time, you know. I, Tammy, Louise, Jason, we're all straight up, unreconstructed, traditional, orthodox, Calvinist ministers. We say the creeds without flinching. They're just going to choir or some other place. It's okay. They're not mad. We say the creeds without flinching. I joke about how I look over the congregation and see at what points of the creed people's lips stop moving, like I'm not so sure I believe this part. I say the creed without flinching. There's not an unorthodox bone in my body. This is not about compromising the Christian message. This is about making sure that the Christian message doesn't get stuck in some kind of cultural food fight. Let's look beyond our relatively comfortable suburban environment. Trust me, I know that there's a lot of stuff that goes on behind these well-manicured lawns and the nice houses with the big fancy cars out front. Nobody knows that better than a pastor. So this is not to say that people in Upper St. Clair and Peters Township and Bethel Park and Mount Lebanon don't have problems and challenges. Nobody knows those things better than pastors do. It's not about that. But it is to say, relatively speaking, there are whole realms of things that we don't have to deal with. Other people have to deal with all that personal stuff that we all face, and on top of that, they have to deal with the implications of race in our environment. So, let's work for justice and fellowship among all races, and while we're doing that, let's strengthen our relationship with people of other faiths. There's more detail we could talk about there, but that's to say that those of us that have been thinking about this, and several of those folks are in the room here, said, let's lift this up to session, let's make these themes in what we try to make Westminster to be about. So, what are we doing? And we're getting close to the end here, and then we'll talk. Well, we're doing all kinds of things, as you know. Every single year, we have at least one team, sometimes a couple of teams, go to Haiti. And that's an international mission, but not coincidentally, Haitians are almost all black. And the people that go to the Haitian ministry develop close friendships. Some have gone 12, 13 years from here and have real friendships with the folks there. And among other things, that's crossing racial barriers to do that. City Mission Westminster is probably the largest single supporter of City Mission, right down here in what I grew up calling Little Washington. And those are people struggling largely with addiction issues. A disproportionately large number of them are people of color. And we've got a number of people on the board there or working with folks. Grace Memorial, that I've already mentioned, after Gavin spent a couple of years with us, I was having lunch with Ron Peters one day, African-American guy, former professor at the seminary, founder of the Metro Urban Institute, former head of a consortium of theological schools in Atlanta. Ron and I were having lunch one day, and I said, I got this guy who might be good for Grace Memorial. What do you think? And so we introduced Gavin to Ron. Ron introduced Gavin to the people. Gavin's now the pastor at Grace Memorial Church in the Hill District. Some of our members go every couple weeks to a book group where five or six people from Westminster and five, six, seven people from Grace Memorial sit down together and read books about race and faith and reconciliation and redemption and have built real friendships there. Homewood. Dan's the expert on this. We can talk about that a little bit. There's a collaborative agencies in Homewood, predominantly African-American, not entirely, that we're very much involved with in all kinds of ways. We have people contributing expertise of various kinds and some money. There'll be a campaign for Homewood coming up. Dan might want to say a word about that. A couple years ago in February, we sponsored at Pittsburgh Seminary a program on race and justice, and we had people coming from churches all around the presbytery. On February 8th coming up, I'll be speaking at the presbytery meeting, Pittsburgh Presbytery meeting, because I was invited by what's called the Amos 524 team. And in case you, just in case you don't remember what Amos 5:24 is, that's the text from the prophet about justice. And this team is about promoting racial reconciliation and conversation, cooperation within the presbytery. When I got the invitation to speak at the presbytery on that day, it's because racial justice is the theme of the day. And I have to tell you, I preach all the time. You know that. Preaching doesn't spook me. But to be invited as the white guy from the suburbs to speak to the whole presbytery about racial reconciliation, I have to say, that feels to me like a high honor and an awesome responsibility, because there are lots of ways to do that badly. On the other hand, the fact that they asked the white guy from the big church in Upper St. Clair to come and talk on that issue means that Westminster, because of the work of dozens of people, and many of you are in the room now, because of the work of dozens of people, not just in going and helping those people, but in building real friendships and cooperation and relationships that we care about, we're gaining credibility. And that's a marvelous thing. As you know, John Galbraith, I'm going to stop in a second, John Galbraith went to Selma with Dr. King. And some people left at the time. Some people didn't like it. Some people painted ugly stuff on the front door. But Westminster has a tradition from the beginning of caring about reconciliation and racial justice, from the very first pastor and from the marches 50-some years ago. So that's just by way of saying we're still standing in that tradition. We've got dozens of people actively involved. And we do that because we take Jesus seriously. Jesus says, love your neighbor as yourself, do to others as you would have them do to me. And he would break down the walls of hostility that divide us, and as Paul says, would make us ministers of God's reconciling work in the world. That's what we want to do. We got people already doing it. Let me stop talking and invite any questions or comments that you have or things that anybody wants to add. Please.
I'm curious about your comment earlier about reconciliation.
Yeah, well, about why some black folk don't like the word reconciliation? Is that what you're picking up on? Yeah, thanks for bringing that back. You know, reconciliation sounds like a sort of obvious word. Why wouldn't everybody be for that? Some of the African-American friends, when you really become friends and when they tell you what they really think about stuff, some of them will say, you know, we have trouble with the word reconciliation because reconciliation sounds like two people have a fight and they need to kiss and make up and both of them are probably at fault. And they want to say, we've been on the receiving end of most of this stuff. We didn't do slavery. We didn't start slavery. We didn't start segregation. We're the ones whose kids are spending decades in prison for things that other people get away with. The language of reconciliation sounds like, well, let's all just admit our faults here and let's all just kiss and make up and get along, recognizing how we're all part of the problem. And I think the people with whom we've become friends would say, yeah, of course. I mean, there's stuff that we need to do in our communities as well. But reconciliation frames it in a way that, from their perspective, sounds a little too much like, yeah, we're all at fault here, so let's just move forward from here. As opposed to acknowledging, again, this thing that they care so much about, acknowledging what they call the white privilege. And white folks often get very defensive about that. Because, oh, I'm not privileged, I work for what I have, and all that kind of stuff. That's not what they mean. They mean we don't have to think about being white in a way that they have to think about being black. Let's talk about redemption. Let's talk about friendship. Let's talk about the body of Christ. Reconciliation, not the best word, perhaps. And we don't have to agree with that, but you can understand it. And part of the whole point is to understand how people see things the way they do, given their experiences in the world. Does that help?
Yeah.
Comments? Questions? Please, John.
There was a very good article in The Atlantic magazine, I think about a year ago, about redlining,
yeah,
about keeping blacks out of certain neighborhoods. And it highlighted in particular Chicago and Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it very worthwhile.
Article about redlining. I'll just repeat in case everybody couldn't hear. Yeah, redlining is that term that comes from, you know, real estate practices where either literally or metaphorically, realtors would draw a red line about certain neighborhoods, meaning people of color don't get shown houses in those neighborhoods. And there's a long history, very well documented, of that sort of thing. I said before, Don Palumbo, you know, dear friend of many of us, and gone on to the Church Triumphant this last year. Dom used to tell me about coming to Upper St. Clair in the late 40s and early 50s, and he was suspect and had to face some hurdles because his last name ended in a vowel. He was Italian. And then those Italians, we're not so sure what to make of them. Dom Palumbo, pillar of the community, pillar of the church, got some grief for being Italian. Did you know, by the way, that there was a time when some white folk in this country in the 19th century talked about the Irish as not being white? Did you know that? And the British talked about Irish. Who's paler than Irish people? Who is more white than the Irish? Or the Scots-Irish?
The Black Irish, that's where I'm sure, at the Obama, where their ships were sunk.
Ah, okay. All right. So I mean, race is a sorry history in this country. And in the 19th century, people claimed on scientific grounds to develop whole hierarchies of race. Not surprisingly, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant types came off at the top of that hierarchy, and the Irish weren't even quite white. Okay. Other questions, comments? Please, Manny. Good. So the question is, if people want to get involved, how can we expand the circle from however many dozen it is now to more people getting involved? Lots of ways to do that. I'm going to invite Bobby, Dan to say a few words on that.
I'll talk about the Grapes Memorial Book Club. This is a group of people, as Jim has pointed out, that has anywhere between maybe 8 and 20 come each week, and it's usually about half and half. We carpool from the Galleria at 5:45, and we discuss books that some of us have done ahead of time. We don't have to have read the book ahead of time. We're taking a break over Christmas. Our next meeting is January 8th. If you are interested in knowing, just email me, and I'll make sure that we wait for you at the Galleria. For January, everybody's going to suggest a new book because we just finished one, and we have something that we're reading in the intro. So if you want me to forward you that information, I can do that. But you're welcome to come. It's a delightful group. As Jim has pointed out, we've got to know each other. We've been doing this for about a year and a half, and not everybody comes every time, not the same people come every time, and that's okay. It's a way of getting, it's beyond comfort, it's really affection, I would say, that we have developed for one another. And they are very frank with us and say, as Jim has pointed out, this, something about this bothers us. And we do the same. And so we have an open exchange, and it's really a treasure. So I would invite anyone who is interested to try it out.
Well, to me, what's remarkable is that for all the reasons Bobby described, they talk about these very provocative books about race and racism and all the kind of things that Jim just said, as if we were not there.
Yeah.
They don't change it because there's some white folks there. And it dawned on me, that this is just remarkable. That 6, 8, 10 white folks from Upper St. Clair can be sitting in a black church on the hill, and they, I guess the word I use, honor us by allowing us to be there and not changing how we are because there's white folks there. And I just found it remarkable. And I would encourage you to try it once and see if you find it remarkable too. Because it really is. But it also demonstrates white folks and black folks can do this stuff together. We had a series of dinners with Valley, which is a church in Dartmouth. And in preparation for those dinners, I think 8 of us were sitting with 8 members of Valley, all black. And this elderly woman was almost in tears. And she said, "This is remarkable. Our kids would be so proud of us." And I asked, "What do you mean by that?" And she said, "Here's 8 white folks and 8 black folks talking together about all these topics that are profound to all of us." And she was in tears over that it was possible for white folks and black folks to do this together.
So there's a whole range of things that people can do, you know, in varying degrees of time and energy and commitment. Jan Bauman's opportunities to, you know, go to the food bank and so forth. And those are good things to do, but they're all, those sort of, you know, two-hour mission things are about, you know, white folks from the suburbs going and helping poor people, disproportionately large numbers of whom are people of color, to get food or something. And that's not a bad thing to do. That's a good thing to do. And for some people, that sort of opens the door to thinking, why are these people poor? Then I should go deeper on this. So that's a good thing to do. But that's just, that can just reinforce our sense that, you know, we're helping those folk. The kind of stuff that Bobby and Dan are talking about, that takes a lot of time. It's relationship. And, you know, relationship is spending time together. Not I've come here to do something for you, but I want to get to know you. Tell me what the world looks like from your perspective, and let's share. And that takes time and energy. So everything from, you know, show up at the food bank for a couple hours on a Saturday morning to go down to City Mission and have lunch with homeless folk there, or drug-addicted folk recovering and Jesus is becoming part of their lives. Those can open the doors to seeing things in a new way. Part of the best stuff happens in these ongoing relationships. And that's what's so encouraging, and that's why the white guy from the big church in the suburbs got invited to come and talk on Race Relations Day at the Presbytery. Because Westminster's starting to get credibility on this issue again. I mean, we had it in the days of John Galbraith. We probably had it in the days of Laird Stewart, I suppose. So at a minimum, what everybody can do is be supportive of this. At a minimum, if you have the time and energy to get involved, come to the book group or whatever, talk to Dan about Homewood. There are ways you can get involved. But at a minimum, being supportive of Westminster's outreach, and if you hear somebody grousing about this kind of stuff, say, well, no, this is just Jesus, you know? Be an interpreter to the people that you see who wonder, why are we doing this stuff? Well, here's why. So there's a lot of ways that you can contribute. The church as a body. The church as a body includes people who just show up at the food bank, people who do a sort of half-day mission, the Haiti folks. And again, Haiti's not primarily about race, but race is just all woven across that. And talk to the Conleys, talk to the Hartmans about that. And just be supportive of the fact that some people are really building relationship, and people at the presbytery and at the seminary and some of these churches are saying to themselves, wow, Westminster's doing that? That's an encouraging thing. Doug, you want to comment?
Yeah, I'd like to broaden that out just a little bit, because additional involvement today focuses on the things that have already started. But there could be more things that are in your mind about what we could do, and I think there's a lot of support from the Outreach Commission who would say, we just got an idea from somebody who wants to do this. And we all look around the circle and say, well, who's not busy enough that we can go ahead and support that? And the fact is, we're just a bunch of people in a row. We are not you. And so I would solicit your ideas or your encouragements, and I would specifically suggest that, for example, the Shenley Heights Community Development Project is a daycare school right now in financial extreme difficulties. Wouldn't it be great if we had some more people who could join in their strategy of uniting and collaborating the nonprofit groups in the Hill and in Homewood to do a tremendous amount of raising all those folks in that burden? And your professional skills are very much a need. The question is, how do we define what that all needs to be? Well, that shouldn't be a reason for saying no. That should be a reason for saying, well, why don't we go meet with somebody and see what we can put together? There's a tremendous amount of additional new work that you all could be part of. We need to hear from you.
Thanks, Doug. We need to quit here. Short word, Dan?
Jim and I gave a presentation about our work at Homewood to the board of the seminary. And more than an hour in the discussion. Mm-hmm. And their comment afterward was that Westminster is a role model church for the concept we've been discussing. And that's because they didn't know there was a white, suburban, well-off church that embraced these racial things in anywhere near what we've discussed today. And they are delighted, and the presbytery says the same thing.
Yeah. We have to quit. I'm afraid we're out of time. At least I'm out of time. You guys can stay. I have to go do a service. So let me just say briefly what's happening next week. Reverend John Wallace is coming. John Wallace is an enormously impressive man. He's a professor of sociology at Pitt, left a tenured position at the University of Michigan to come back to Pittsburgh. He's from Homewood. So he's a professor of sociology at the University of Pittsburgh. He's a pastor of a church in Homewood, entrepreneurial guy starting all kinds of stuff to help to redeem the community of Homewood. He will be here at the seminar with me next week at the same time. And John's going to talk for a while, and he and I will talk, and we'll all talk. So we get a chance to see one of the people with whom we've been blessed to be in a partnership and growing friendship there. And John will also be speaking at our two other services, 8:30 and 11, next week. So to be continued, I'm afraid we have to run. Thanks so much for being here, and I hope to see you next week.